Nationwide protests in Iran against Islamist rule enter a sixth week. Videos show student protesters rallying at more than 20 universities, including a women's school in Tehran.
In the picture, we see a lot of women, a lot of students without hijab and with hijab, hand to hand, chanting freedom.
Plus, Iran's suspected provision of attack drones to Russia puts Israel in a quandary. A correspondent from one of Israel's top newspapers explains.
The dilemma is one of the most complex Israel had for decades, I would say.
And later in the program, a Lebanese-American former prisoner in Iran updates us on efforts to free other Americans languishing in Iranian jails. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Outrage at Iran's deadly crackdown on more than a month of mostly peaceful anti-government protests is spreading worldwide. There also is growing concern in the West about Iran appearing to provide deadly drones for Russia's aggression against Ukraine. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
From the heart of London in Trafalgar Square to the streets of Berlin and Toronto, demonstrations continue against Iran's theocratic government and the death of a young woman there in police custody. 22-year-old Mahsa Amini died last month while under arrest by Iran's morality police. Iran says she died of a heart attack. Her family cries foul. Since then, Iranians have flooded their streets, demanding a change from an Islamic republic at odds with the mostly secular youth. Shopkeepers went on strike while activists have called for student walkouts. Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei recently spoke of students who grew up in Iran, traveled abroad, and gave the fruits of a country's labor to what he called the enemy. Meanwhile, Ukraine and Western powers have alleged that Iran is now supplying Russia with kamikaze drones and the training to use them in the Kremlin's ongoing war on neighboring Ukraine. Pentagon spokesman Brigadier General Pat Ryder at an agency briefing as carried by the Associated Press.
What that means, obviously, again, we continue to see Iran be complicit in terms of exporting terror, not only in the Middle East region, but now also to Ukraine.
And while Iran and Russia deny the allegations, Britain, France, and Germany have joined Ukraine in calling for a probe into the origins of the drones used to attack the former Soviet Republic. The United States has gone so far as to say there will be no new nuclear deal at this time. Coordinator for Strategic Communications at the National Security Council, John Kirby, speaking at an agency event as carried by the Associated Press.
We are way far apart with the Iranians in terms of a return to the deal. So we're just simply not focused on that right now. What we are focused on is making sure that we're holding the regime accountable for the way they're treating peaceful protesters in their country and supporting those protesters. And we are focused, as I said in my opening statement, on making sure we're holding Iran and Russia accountable for these arms sales.
It is a statement at odds with claims by the Islamic Republic that the United States is in a rush to reach a new nuclear deal as soon as possible, while also accusing the U.S. of fanning the flames of political unrest in Iran. The U.S. pulled out of the deal in 2018 under then-President Donald Trump. But this weekend in Washington, as in cities all over the world, the focus was less on nuclear talks and more on an Iranian government seemingly involved in human rights violations both at home and abroad. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
University students are taking the lead in many of Iran's latest protests, staging rallies on campuses across the country. One video shared on Iranian opposition Twitter account 1500 Tazvir appears to show young women at Tehran's female-only Al-Zahra University repeatedly chanting the word Azadi, or freedom, on Monday. Another video, apparently from Monday, posted by activist Twitter account @Vahid, shows staff at a medical center chanting, "We will fight, we will die, we will take back Iran." Arash Sagarchi is a managing editor in VOA's Persian service. I sat down with him in our studio and asked why he found the women's protest at Al-Zahra University to be so significant.
As we know, the protest started when Mahsa Amini was died in handing police. And after that, the protests started in across the country in Iran. And after 2-3 weeks, Iranian regime tried to say, hey, some people, some corrupted woman wants to not have a hijab, trying to discredit this protest. But what we saw in Al-Zahra University, which is a kind of religious university in Tehran, and usually students wear full hijab with chador. But in the picture, we see a lot of women, a lot of students without hijab and with hijab, hand to hand, chanting freedom. That shows people in that kind of religious university, they are demanding something bigger than what the government is trying to tell.
Like demanding more than just the freedom to wear or not wear a hijab, but something more.
Exactly. We are hearing a lot of chant against the dictator, against the Ali Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader. They want clearly regime change.
What can you tell us about how you and your colleagues at VOA Persian have been vetting these videos that you receive, and what are the sources of these images as well?
You and me work a lot about this situation in Iran. Every time there is a big protest, they shut down the internet. So we learned in the past years how we can deal with that. Fortunately, many brave Iranians send us directly content, including video pictures and sometimes texts, and inform us about protests where to start, protests, how it goes, how they, government manage that or attack to them, and detail like that. The good thing is we have some tools to vet that. We use all resource we have to make sure we are delivering the fair, correct, and, reliable material from inside Iran. And it is a phenomenon. It is a phenomenon because we can give them to others the news right away. If there is a protest in south of Iran, in Bandar Abbas, in 1 hour we can provide material to everybody. So they can get the reliable news from us.
Arash Sagarchi, managing editor in the VOA Persian service, thank you for joining Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you so much.
Media rights activists say Iran has jailed at least 41 journalists as it cracks down on the nationwide protests, with women accounting for about half of those detained. Kiran Nazish, founding director of the New York-based Coalition for Women in Journalism, spoke to me about those detentions. She explained why the number of female journalists being jailed is particularly alarming.
Women in Iran are already in minority. I think about 25 to 30% of media workers are women. And in that minority, almost half of women journalists have been put into prison amongst all the journalists. So we think that there is a targeted attack. There has always been a targeted censorship and intimidation towards women in the media, even if they're covering stories not related to politics or democracy, even if they're covering health or education, they are threatened. We have been consistently in touch with many journalists and lawyers, in Iran. And so these consistencies in that kind of environment, these consistencies have been there. But what is happening now is that even journalists who work for media approved by the state, journalists who work for those are getting arrested for a tweet or something they did in the past. And I think these protests, Mahsa Amini's protests and the crackdown that the government is imposing on any kind of dissent is also being used to purge journalists who had reported something before and are not very active right now.
Well, you talked about how there's a disproportionate number of female journalists who are among those detained at the moment. What evidence are you getting from your sources inside Iran that these women are being deliberately targeted because of their gender?
In terms of evidence, it's hard to get any information outside of prison. What we do know is from families and lawyers, majority of the journalists don't have access outside of the prison, and the families and lawyers that have been trying to get in touch with them are not able to get in contact in majority of the cases. So it's very hard to tell what's happening inside of the prison, but what we know, how they're arrested or what they're told, the kind of language that is used. One word that consistently comes up with family members or lawyers that we speak to family members of the journalists. One word that repeats almost from Shiraz to others to Tehran is torture method. And what they mean by that is that they would quote something that these journalists have written about in the past, and then they would call them enemies of the state or trying to topple the government and these kind of accusations. And then we hear that as women are arrested, they're told, they're shamed for being women and being journalists at the same time. And that as women, there's certain language that in Persian, I can't say so much in English, but is used that is very gendered and that accuses them of being traitors despite of being women.
Can you tell us about how challenging it has been for you and your colleagues to get information about the situation of those detained journalists, the women, from family members and from lawyers whom you have been able to get in touch with, bearing in mind, of course, that the Iranian authorities really frown upon their citizens, you know, communicating with people in the West?
Yeah, so we have different groups of, we have peer support networks in different countries, including one for Iran. Majority of the journalists on that network are outside of Iran. Some are inside Iran. And through them, you know, this has been set up before this whole thing happened. But when this happened, a lot of that helped us connect with families and journalists inside the country by informal means. And sometimes getting information through them has been very helpful. But when the Mahsa Amini protests began, one thing that started happening is that we were talking to different journalists to verify information about, say, you know, photojournalist Eyal Damori when she was arrested. We were trying to verify information through different journalists on the ground. And eventually, you know, as weeks went over, days went over, a lot of journalists we were speaking to started getting arrested as well. A lot of them moved. A lot of them moved to different locations. So, you know, we have been constantly trying to reconnect with different journalists. We've also been, you know, connected with the Association of Journalists in Iran. And that has been just really revealing of what journalists are facing on the ground, because every day, we get several reports of an incident in a certain part of Iran, from arrest to somebody going and changing their location to how frustrated journalists are with the disconnect, of the internet and, you know, the internet shutdown. And that has disconnected journalists from being in touch with each other and having access to each other and also getting the information out.
Kiran Nazish, founding director of the Coalition for Women in Journalism, speaking to us from Vancouver, Canada. Thank you very much for joining Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you.
Visit voanews.com and click the Iran tab at the top of the page for updates on Iran throughout the day. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. Iran's alleged supply of attack drones to Russia for use against Ukraine is creating a dilemma for Israel, Iran's main regional foe. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has been increasing verbal pressure on Israel to provide weapons to his forces so that they can stop what he calls the terror of the suspected Iranian drones. But Israel so far has only offered civilian assistance to Ukraine. I sat down in Washington with visiting Israeli journalist Ariel Kahana, a diplomatic correspondent for the Israel Hayom newspaper, and asked why Israel is holding back on stronger aid.
So Israel is in a very complex dilemma when it comes to the war between Russia and Ukraine. Now, Zelensky, not for the first time, and it's well understood in Israel, he's doing his job trying to press, let's say, the sensitive buttons from Israeli point of view. Now, the same he did, even in sharper words, on the beginning, comparing what they are going through to the Holocaust, to the Shoah. And that clearly was a mistake, and he knows that. Same here. I mean, I'm not sure that he can convince the Israelis to change the policy regarding the war if he will explain to us, to the Israelis, that Iran is such a big danger. We know that already. And still, generally, Israel is choosing the policy it is choosing. So I'm not sure that the wording by Zelensky today, I'm not sure that would make the change. But again, he's making the efforts from his point of view It's well understood.
What are you hearing from sources in Israel, let's say in the Israeli government, about how they react to this kind of pressure from Zelensky about Iran?
No doubt, since the beginning of the war, and most sharply in last weeks when we see the Iranian involvement, there is a dilemma by the politicians, by officials in the government, by senior officers in the IDF, in the army. And the dilemma is one of the most complex Israel had for decades, I would say. And there are so many ways, perspective, how to see the war. Naturally, you might say that Israel, of course, is a democracy, and therefore the Israelis and the government and the people are supporting democracy. I can tell you, I was in the beginning of the war in the Ukrainian embassy in Tel Aviv. You could see plenty of assistance sent by Israelis to the Ukrainian people, not by the government. So there is no question where the Israeli heart is, or the Israeli's heart is. But then you have actually an air border with Russia, because Russian troops are in Syria. And once we will go completely, strongly, giving ammunition to Zelensky, to Ukraine, like they ask for, the meaning is that in some way we are joining the war, not by warring only, but also by acting, fighting with Russia. Should we do that? Should Israel do that? Now, some are saying yes. Some are saying yes. But many are saying no. This, although we have all sympathy to the Ukrainian people, of course, it's not our war. And moreover, Israel has its own security challenges, as everybody knows. It's the most threatened country around the world. So should we open another unnecessary war? So, and I gave you just two ways to see it. While there are plenty of other reasons, and we can go through it for hours, I believe.
Let's take a look at the Israeli election that is coming up very soon. And we have Yair Lapid, the prime minister, center-left, and then we have Benjamin Netanyahu, the nationalist, right-wing leader, both trying to form the next government. How would either of them handle this issue if they lead the next Israeli government?
So I'll try to be as short as I can. Let's go, first of all, to the public declarations by both. Current Prime Minister Lapid, when he was foreign office minister, he said he actually condemned Russia a few times. Netanyahu never condemned Russia. From the other hand, in the last days, Netanyahu broke his silence and said that he will consider supplying ammunition to Ukraine. That is definitely a change by Netanyahu, because until a few days ago, he refused by any circumstances to talk about the war. So that's what is said publicly. Another major force you have to take into account is the security establishment in Israel. The question, what will they recommend, will definitely affect the new prime minister, whoever it's going to be. So I don't know how it's going to change, if at all. And what I also don't know, if we're going to have any stable government after the current elections, because as long as you don't have legitimate government, the current government doesn't have actually the support of the Knesset. So as long as you don't have a stable, supported government, I'm not sure you can change the policy.
Ariel Kahana, the senior diplomatic correspondent for Israel Hayom, thank you for speaking to Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you very much.
Iranian state media say Westerners are among those whom security forces have arrested since the protests began in mid-September. Lebanese-American Nizar Zaka was himself detained in Iran for 4 years on what the U.S. said were bogus charges until his release in 2019. He also is one of the founders of U.S. nonprofit group Hostage Aid Worldwide, which advocates for the release of hostages globally. The Biden administration says it has an unwavering commitment to bring home U.S. nationals held hostage or wrongfully detained abroad. Zaka told me what he knows about the latest detentions of Western nationals in Iran.
It's actually one American, and you have French and different nationality, but you have also, there's a larger number is Afghan nationals. that were arrested, and they are currently, and the American, we still, we hope that it's still, it will be released, it will not be sentenced or arrested. It's like just a quick arrest and release thing. So we hope that this is the status, so we keep it, we're not talking about it at this time, but just since the Iranian regime announced it, so we're just talking about it.
Regarding Bakir Namazi, the father of Siamak, who was released, or he was allowed to leave Iran on October 5th, that was described as a humanitarian gesture. Are you aware of any concessions or gestures made by the United States in return for Bakir Namazi's freedom?
So far, there is no gesture. There is nothing in return. In fact, the Iranian wanted to do a gesture, and it was the easiest win to please the UN and to act as they are doing something for Mr. Antonio Guterres. So that's why they released him. They allowed him to leave, and he's currently in Abu Dhabi. So yet to know. In fact, by allowing Siamak to have a furlough and then sent back to prison to ward number 4 and then do LF, this was very damaging. And we have the indication that we feel like the Iranian wanted to have a good gesture and waiting for another good gesture from the US. And since there were nothing done, they sent Siamak back.
I've reported personally that several sources knowledgeable about U.S.-Iran prisoner negotiations have said that Iran is primarily interested in getting money from the United States in return for releasing the Americans who are in Iran, rather than in doing a swap for Iranians who were jailed in the United States. And Iranian officials have said multiple times that they do want to get Iranians in the United States freed. What do you think Iran really wants from future deals or negotiations?
Definitely what you're saying is very accurate, that the Iranians are the least interested to get Iranian back, especially because most of the Iranian that they will be released will be a minor sentence. And there will, this Iranian will rather stay in the U.S. and not go back to Iran. But what they are, the only person who they might be interested in getting him back, which is impossible, is the guy who tried to assassinate the ambassador of Saudi Arabia in Washington, D.C., in Cafe Milano a few years ago. So this is what Iran is, the only person who Iran would like to get him out, and they will not do that at this time. But definitely they are more interested in having some of their money unfreezed, that is freezed by South Korea, Japan, and Iran. And this is, I believe, where the discussion were evolving before to unfreeze money. And in between, the Iranian will always put that they want to release some Iranian because for face-saving matters, to show that they are concerned about the Iranian people as well. They are not just kidnappers who are waiting for money.
What do you think the United States can do realistically to make hostages a priority, as you've been saying it should? What measures do you think are realistic? Would you support, for example, the freeing of Iranian funds or some other kind of step?
This is a question that everybody asks us. Oh, are you saying you don't want to freeze the funds, so you want the hostages to stay? No. I believe currently the administration should do anything they can, everything they can, to get the hostages back. If they want to unfreeze, let them unfreeze. But in return, this is the important part, not to leave anyone behind. And this was, they dragging their feet, they always leave someone behind. Now they got the Venezuela, they left 4 behind. Last time they got the Americans, they left people behind. Especially this is Obama and the Biden administration. This is a problem. You need to close this file. Let's get our hostages back and then put a very firm policy that will be so painful for any country to take an American hostage.
Well, Nizar Zaka of Hostage Aid Worldwide, thank you very much for joining us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you.
That's it for today's program. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join me again next week for another Flashpoint Iran.